Hi there and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years and I'm fascinated by how the companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds and journeys, learning from their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. So without further ado, to today's episode. It's the first podcast of 2026, and as they say, go big or go home. We are only a few weeks away from the start of the Six Nations, and joining me today is Ronan Dunn, a chairman, CEO, board strategic advisor, and independent non-executive director. Between 2016 and 2022, he served at Verizon as president and CEO of Verizon Wireless, Verizon Consumer Group, and most recently as strategic advisor to the CEO. At Verizon Consumer Group, he led the teams responsible for delivering wireline, wireless and television products and services to more than 100 million consumers. Prior to Verizon, he was CEO of the leading UK mobile operator Telefonica UK, or O2, for almost a decade. He has held other industry roles that speak to the leadership and expertise in the telecom world. Today, he serves as chair of the Six Nations, the organising body of the Six Nations Championship and the Autumn Nations Series, and chair of Core Labs, a RegTech and product intelligence platform. Ronan also serves as non-exec director to British multinational retailer Marks & Spencer's and Balance in Business, and is a strategic advisor to a number of companies in the telecom and technology sector. Ronan's charitable work focuses primarily on education and providing opportunities for the next generation. Ronan, you are very welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Aidan.
Now, a proper place to start. How did you end up in the telecom sector?
Purely by accident, and sincerely that I followed my boss, right, is the honest answer. So when I first went to London back in 87, I was working in banking and I ended up going to work for one of my customers, so the gamekeeper turned poacher. And out of that, I ended up working for Jerry Murphy in a thing called the old National Freight Company, NFC. And they merged, and my boss decided after the merger he was going to move on, and he got poached to be the group finance director of what was to become O2, the mobile group. We were actually called MMO2 at that time when we were publicly listed. And I'd been carrying his bags for a few years at NFC. So he said, why don't you come and do the same for me? So I was the deputy group CFO. So it was nothing to do with telecoms. Right. It was simply following my boss for a job.
And the whole CF role, had you gone through the old qualified as an accountant and didn't want to be an auditor for the rest of your life?
Precisely. I mean, I trained here in Deloitte. It was Touche Ross in those days. Left pretty much as soon as I qualified. I had never any intention of being an auditor. Always been fascinated by financial markets. I'd probably love to be doing your job, if the truth be told. So I went to banking straight away and I got an accountant's job, and then I got to switch over to the banking side. And really, the accountancy qualification was, I considered, like an MBA. It was a business qualification. So I kind of used that to get my entry into the market in the UK.
Yeah, it's funny, like the amount of people we've, both entrepreneurs and professional business people who have the accountancy as the base foundation for what they do. And I always wonder, you know, I say to each of them, why do you think it is?
Well, to be honest with you, I think there's two things. Look, I'm a hugely proud chartered accountant. I think it's an unbelievably good qualification. But the key is, in any business, if you don't understand how the maths works, then you can't do any other job. You can't be a CEO, you can't be a COO, you can't be a chief revenue officer. So financial literacy in a business sense, I think, is essential to having real business acumen.
Yeah. And it's funny because I always have this saying that, you know, finance without strategy is just numbers, and strategy without finance is just dreaming.
Right? Yeah, that's very true. And I think actually when you put the pieces together, probably the thing I learned was, you know, not to preempt the questions, but I never expected to end up being in general management. I thought I was a decent finance director and I'd get promoted or I'd go to a bigger job or whatever. And somebody else saw in me, you know, the potential to be a general manager, a CEO, and we'll no doubt touch on that. But what was interesting was the bit that joined the dots is finance people who only know how to say no stay in finance.
You have to have that commercial angle to
yourself. You have to understand how you allocate the risk budget, the risk appetite of the business, and being able to come in and say, I wouldn't do it that way, but I think I can find a way to get it done, actually is the commercialism that really helps a business.
And do you think there's a, you know, when you're looking at, and you know, a lot of the companies that you'd be advising to and things like that, do you think there is a lack of that joined up thinking between the finance departments and the commercial departments and things like that, that it takes either a very good CFO or a very good CEO to be able to go, no, I know there's tram lines, but we've got to grow.
Definitely.
Here.
I actually think that the bigger the organization gets, the more they sometimes get blinded by process and control. And actually, I think sometimes in smaller businesses, everybody has kind of got multiple hats in their job. Yeah. You don't have a tight JD in that sense. So I think the danger is in bigger companies, you have a centralized function that says, this is how that we do it around here. And interestingly, when O2 was bought by Telefonica, the deal that was done was a normal acquisition. But in every other acquisition they'd made, and particularly across Latin America, where they bought about a dozen businesses, they integrated everything on day one. Mm. The handshake with the chairman was, you guys know how to run a business in the UK, and therefore we will give you more latitude than we would to others. We'll give you a budget envelope at the beginning of the year, but we'll leave you to run the business. And it frustrated the hell out of the finance department in Madrid for a while. But what they realized was, doing it the way they had done it as a centrally controlled activity wasn't going to work in a dynamic competitive market like the UK. And they were proven right.
And I always find it very interesting when we're talking about mergers and acquisitions, vast majority of the commentary is always around the viewpoint from the acquirer rather than the acquiree, right? That they just go, oh, well, you know, we're going in and we're going to get the cost synergies here, the revenue synergies. Talk to me through, because you would have been through that time, in terms of, you know, taking going with the deal, and that idea of, you know, the cultural fit between where you were going to, also the ability to have the leeway that Telefonica were going to give you as a management team in the UK.
So I'd summarize it before maybe break it down is, I think any good CEO needs to earn the right to ask for forgiveness, not permission. Mm-hmm. And that's the mandate that you need to have. Now, you have to earn that over time. And the proposition we put was, look, we run a business in a very different market, much more competitive than the domestic Spanish market was at the time. But guess what? We know what we're doing. So in those circumstances, let us drive the business in a much more brand and customer way than you might be used to. But the quid pro quo is, we'll commit to grow this business at a higher rate than any of your other businesses. Yeah. And so that was the kind of, because I don't think you can get a free hand. That's not fair to your shareholders. Mm. What you can do is say, here's the trade. If I commit to grow at 7.5% per annum when everybody else is at, 2 or 3%, give me a bit more flexibility. And the other specific thing with the finance team was, I said, don't mark my score line by line on the P&L. Mm-hmm. Mark me on the outcome. Because guess what? I might actually execute my plan slightly differently to what I thought at the beginning of the year.
Yeah.
But if I deliver what I committed in the way of growth in revenues, in customers, and ultimately in profit, then don't worry about the lines.
Yes, it's
just
a bit,
worry
I
about the
to,
answer.
I would say to people, it's a bit like sausages, right? You don't care what goes into the sausage.
Precisely.
You just care that they taste nice at the
and
end.
And I think that's
it.
A huge point sometimes that gets lost in organizations is, and it's not micromanagement, but there's an element of that. And we spent more on marketing, for example, in the UK than any other business in Telefonica. But guess what? We grew faster. And we were more profitable.
But it was also reflective of the market that you were in.
Correct. Much more directly competitive market than most, if not all, of their other marketplaces.
And then do you think, because ultimately, like if you look at it, albeit at the time, Telefonica, their domestic market wouldn't have been like the UK, but it eventually became like the UK.
Correct.
And the rest of Europe became like the UK.
It did. And what's interesting is now, the O2 brand, which survived being acquired by a company that used Movistar as its mobile brand everywhere else in the world, the O2 brand is now used by Telefonica in Spain. And that was kind of the proof of this is an agile brand that understands how to operate in a highly competitive market and get a balance between value for money and quality. Mm. And so we actually, in a way, infected the parent rather than the parent infect the child, as it were. Yeah. You know,
which you know, again, speaks to be fair to the Telefonica management at the time, a great amount of insight into that decision to, okay, you're really good at what you do, go and do it, and we might learn something from you.
And there was a real cultural insight there, not to overplay it, but the chairman at the time was a guy called Cesar Alierta, and he came to Dublin to learn English.
Right.
And there was a real affinity, kind of cultural affinity, between the Spanish and the Irish. Mm-hmm. And there was a trust there. So I'm still close to a lot of the people in Telefonica in a way that's different from having worked with them. It's like family. And that bond of trust gave us more space to operate than might otherwise have been the case.
You weren't necessarily given a free pass, but you were. There was an
assumption of trust. And there's a great little anecdote, briefly. The day the deal closed, we arranged the following Monday morning to all go as a management team to Madrid and present to others in the Telefonica executive. And all the due diligence had been done, all this. But now we were kind of presenting as, this is our business, this is what we're doing. So we took the very first flight out of Heathrow. We arrived. When we got there, at the official starting time, half the people hadn't shown up from the Madrid side. Then when they rolled in, they sorted out coffee. They chatted with each other. Back in those days, there was still smoking in the office, etc. When we finished and got back on the plane and went home, our team was, forgive me, but pissed off because they had come prepared with a 60-page deck and we didn't get much done.
Yeah.
And the feedback from the other side was, who do these people think they are? They think they're going to do business with this without even being polite enough to shake our hands, ask us about our families.
Have a cigarette and have a coffee.
Precisely. And that was the real insight was, you need to build the dialogue, build the relationship. And we did, and I had the privilege of running the business for almost a decade. So we were able to build into that a kind of cultural affinity that said, look, we're still going to mark your homework at the end of the year, but if you know how to run it, we'll leave you the space to do
it. And I do think there's an awful lot to be said for that in terms of when you know, whether you're the CEO of one big company or you're the CEO of a company within it, there is no point in hiring somebody and then doing the job yourself.
Precisely. And I'm sure we'll come on to it, but the culture in the United States, fundamentally different.
Well, that's right. So let's use that and switch to it now. So you've been in a Western European, you know, albeit, you know, Spain is definitely different to the UK, and then you go to America, to Verizon.
And what was fascinating there was, and to give a bit of context for the listeners, so Telefonica decided it had paid cash for the O2 group, 28 billion euros, and had paid down no debt in the intervening years. So when the crash happened, and in the subsequent years, they struggled from a debt burden point of view. So they wanted to create some liquidity and do a merger in the UK with Three. Now, ultimately, European Commission blocked the deal. But the reason I ended up going to the States was I was going to be out of a job and I had a non-compete clause that said I couldn't work in telecoms in Europe. So, but I knew it was coming, so I had time to plan. But roll forward. So September of 2016, I moved to Verizon to be president of Verizon Wireless. And the board had been very focused on the fact that the competitive landscape in the US was changing. Deutsche Telekom had a significant stake in T-Mobile, and they were bringing a lot of the European insight to bear in the US. And a guy called John Ledger was running T-Mobile at the time, and this was before the merger with Sprint. And basically AT&T and Verizon were getting their backsides kicked. So the board were very clear. We want somebody who's used to a European competitive market who will come in, and it'll be a marketing-led, customer-led approach. When I arrived, the culture in Verizon, I mean, unbelievably successful business, at the time worth $400 billion, right? But their view was, two or three of us at the top make all the decisions. Everybody else takes their orders and marches to that tune. And for the first 18 months, in a constructive way, I had a debate with the president, which basically said, you can't have a mandate from the board to come in with a mandate to change and bring different market insight, and then expect me to take orders.
Yeah.
I've got to run this the way I would run it, and, you know, test me on the outcomes.
Yeah. And if you stage, fine, we have that decision.
And it took a while, and in the end there was overall changes in leadership which simplified the structure at the top. But that first 18 months was almost a fight for the principle of how we're going to run this business.
Never mind the actual strategy or anything else.
Precisely.
Like that.
And the good news was I stayed, my boss retired, and we had pretty much five unbroken years of growth and progress after that.
But the competitive dynamic was very different in the US market at that stage than it was, because you had the two, what were the traditional, the bells, and then...
Known as Dumb and Dumber to their competition, actually, AT&T and Verizon.
Yeah.
But huge behemoth in the marketplace and had outstanding network quality, but represented themselves as... like an IBM. They were the incumbent. Nobody ever got fired as a CTO or a CIO for buying IBM. Yeah. Well, the same for a Verizon or an AT&T. But then you had the new scallywags on the market. You had the Sprint PCSs and you had T-Mobile. And they were down and dirty. They were fighting for every single connection on every street corner every week. And we were almost above that.
Yeah.
And the answer was we needed not to become them, but to demonstrate to our customers that we valued their custom just as much as a T-Mobile did or a Sprint did. And that required us to change. And probably the best example was the market had started to go unlimited. So Sprint, who had the weakest network, offered an unlimited tariff. Mm. The CFO at the time at Verizon had literally said publicly to the market, over my dead body.
I remember it.
And I came in September 2016, and I won't go into all of the fine detail, but history records, we launched Unlimited in the first week of February of 2017.
Yeah.
So I walked in and said, if you really have the best network, and everybody said, but we do. And I sat the CTO down and said, so that means that when... usage goes to hell in a handcart because everybody's got unlimited, your network will perform better than anybody else's because you've built the best network. And he said, yes. I said, gotcha.
There you go.
In which case, we've got to let our customers use the network. Yeah. And that was the deal. And that signaled a change because it wasn't just unlimited because it's not about a tariff. It was a mindset shift of we're building it for the customers to use it as opposed to we're building it to polish our egos on the best engineering in the world.
Yeah. And I think that was, and there was an awful lot of other kind of nonsense because you had the whole thing of push to talk and all that other stuff
you
that
did.
Was going on.
And you had calling party pays.
Yeah.
So you had two sets of minutes in your bundle for calling out and for people receiving the call as well. Because if you called a mobile, you had to pay.
And like the other, I always remember the other, and like young people listening there and now will just kind of go, what's he doing? I remember having two phones because when you went to the States to work, you had to have a separate a US phone and you had to stick your SIM card into it and work it and over and back. Like it was just
correct.
Crazy.
And the US, for those who are old enough, VHS and Betamax, you know, for your video recorders, well, you had two versions of mobile telephony and Verizon was on one, AT&T was on another. So, for example, at O2, back in those days, we used to give you an AT&T SIM because we couldn't give you a Verizon SIM because it wouldn't work in your phone.
it was incredible. When you look back in both sections, so let's do the kind of the UK side of it, and then we'll do the US side of it. What were the truly hard points in the journey in both of those?
So look, in the UK, there were probably three specific things. One was a very significant incident that almost lost me my job, and I'll come back and talk about that. But the first thing was, transparently, we did a rebrand. So on the 2nd of February 2002, so 02, 02, 02, we became O2. So the old BT Cellnet it was, the ESAT Digiphones, the whatever. We all translated to the new brand. And the new brand was shiny and interesting and everything else is. But brands don't change the reality of what happens on a day-to-day basis. And at the time, I used to do guest lecturing at business school and in Manchester and stuff like that. And one of the things I used to say at the time was, BT Cellnet only led the market in one thing. Our customers left us at a faster rate than anyone else. We were losing the equivalent of Wembley Stadium of customers every month. Now, that's 80,000. But think about it. That's when the market was tiny, when Cellnet had 11 million customers. O2 has 28 million now or something like that. So to lose 80,000, I mean, that's careless,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So we had a reality which was fundamentally different to our brand proposition. So the big first challenge was, how do we close at least some of the gap between perception and reality?
Yeah, yeah.
And the brand helped us. The brand was absolutely a sensational thing to do, and it absolutely carried us. But it carried us because we committed to closing the gap.
Yeah.
So we took out a layer of middle management, and we very explicitly put that money, not to the bottom line, but back into customer service and into retail. And so we showed our people that we were willing to put our money where our mouth was when we said we were going to be customer-led.
Mm.
And then we did a thing called a customer promise. And what a lot of businesses do is they write a customer promise and then they print it and they put it on the wall and they do whatever else. We refused to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But what we did was we used that mantra. And I can still tell you, great value, no catch.
Yeah.
You know, the service you deserve, a network you can rely on, the best range of devices, you know, the best place to work, all of those things. We put them together. And in every meeting that we had, not just in the boardroom, but below that, somebody had the mandate at any one time to say, well, what about the customer?
Yeah.
And around those eight promises that underpinned the customer promise, to actually challenge people and say, are you really making a customer decision
yeah.
or not? And we put our money where our mouth is, because for the first part of it, I was the CFO. So I was the guy who ran a program of 400 million of savings, of which 350 went back into the customer. And that was the first big thing. Second thing was, our network wasn't as strong. And so ultimately what I did was I negotiated a CEO that we did a network joint venture with Vodafone. And that meant that while I didn't have the financial support from the parent, I at least had a commitment to how much capital I'd get because it was contracted. Mm-hmm. And that way we were able to build out the network. And it was never the best in an engineering sense, but it was the one that was optimized to the customer better than anybody else's.
Yeah.
So people felt they could rely on it. And then, and there's two sides to this, we got a big, big boost by the fact that we won the exclusivity for the launch of the iPhone.
Okay.
But people would say, well, lucky and whatever else is. And yes, you always have to be lucky in business. But the reason we won it was because we persuaded Steve Jobs personally that we were more customer-centric than any other operator
in
the UK. And that was exactly what it was.
Yeah.
And they'd been in negotiation with Vodafone for almost a year, and we flew out at very short notice, and we presented them, we storyboarded the journey and the experience for the customer, so much so that they came back on one of their planes and sat with us, and over Marks & Spencer sandwiches in Slough, we signed a deal 3 days later. And they'd been 9 months in the negotiations. The thing that almost blew it all up in the middle of my time was we had a catastrophic network failure back in about 2010. And just when the business was going strong and everyone was, you know, we had momentum and we'd won awards for the brand and other things, we'd moved from being Arsenal sponsor to the Millennium Dome becoming the O2. So big, iconic things. And we had this catastrophic failure where 8 million customers lost access to the network and lost service. And it went for 19 hours. And what happened in the beginning was people were saying, what's the update on the network? After about 14 hours, it became, has your boss resigned yet? It was what the question was coming into the comms team. So for me personally, probably the biggest business crisis was, what do I do? Mm. How do I do the right thing? Is the right thing to fall on my sword and show accountability? Or is my job to get this sorted and move on? So we ended up, I decided that we couldn't, you know, keep these banal updates going. So I offered to do a live interview. And at the time, Sky were our biggest business customer. So I rang the CEO at Sky and I said, look, it could be my last interview, but we'll give somebody an exclusive. If you ever want it, you can have it. And I rang him on his landline in case his mobile didn't work, you know. So Kay Burley did a Down the Line, which you'll be familiar with. Mm. So it's the disemboweled voice at the other end, and I'm looking down the barrel of the camera.
Yeah.
You know, really tough to do, even for people who are used to doing. And they had a satellite truck sitting outside waiting for my resignation, you know, to run the story. And my comms director sat me down beforehand to prep, and he said, look, you need to be able to answer four questions. What happened? Why did it happen? How do you make sure it never happens again? And what are you going to do to make it up to us that have been disrupted? And I said, brilliant, small technical problem. I don't know the answer to any of the four questions. Yeah. So what I did, I grabbed the bull by the horns. And one of the things I would say about my kind of management career is I'm the calmest person in a storm, which mm-hmm. can be very, very powerful. Mm-hmm. It can be discombobulating for some of your colleagues, but it can be very powerful.
It's that idea of you can keep your head when everybody else is losing theirs.
So I had done some broadcast stuff with Kay before, so I kind of knew her. So I grabbed it straight away just on the intro and I said, listen, Kay, before we even start, you know, I know CEOs aren't supposed to, but I've got to apologize. Mm. This just shouldn't have happened. And it happened on my watch. I'm sincerely apologetic. And I said, honestly, if I was an O2 customer and I was tuning into this, I'd want to know what happened. Mm. I'd want to know, how the hell did it happen? How are you going to make sure this never happens again? Mm. And you know what? When you sort it all out, you need to make it up to me. Yeah. So I said, that's what I and 250 of the best people in the industry are working on at the moment. And if you give us a few hours, I think we'll sort it. Yeah. And she said, well, that's kind of refreshingly honest.
Yeah.
And let me off the hook.
Yeah.
And an hour later, customers started to come back on the network and we lived to tell the tale.
Mm. Interesting when you think about that and you put it in context. The your approach now to crisis management today, if it happened today, how would you approach it differently?
Great question. I still think that the role that a CEO needs to play is to be the calmest person in the room. Mm-hmm. In the same way as, and it's a sincere comment, is it doesn't help for the CEO to be the smartest person in the room. Yeah. Actually, sometimes that's suboptimal from a team dynamic point of view. So that idea of listening, and ultimately, Aidan, it's work out what question you're trying to answer before you rush off and answer it. I did a thing in lockdown where I did six lessons of leadership, and one of them was ready, aim, fire is a much better strategy than ready, fire, aim.
I agree with you entirely. Switching tax, I suppose, the because again, when you look at the Telefonica experience and you look at the Verizon experience, do you think large global companies can have one culture?
Really good question. Really good question. And I'll answer a variant of it and then come on to the main question is, I think that question comes up very practically when people merge. Mm. And I've done the integration of merging two businesses. And I would say unequivocally, you cannot merge two cultures. Mm. You have to determine the culture that you want to predominate afterwards. And almost always, it has to be the culture that is of the organization that's taking the lead, i.e. that's put the CEO and the top executives in. Because there's never really a merger, let's be honest about it. There's always one hand that's dominant. More broadly, and this is really relevant to things like the deployment of AI, because one of the issues there is tone of voice is being destroyed. Mm. Brands spend all this time thinking about how they want to come across, and all of a sudden it goes into a machine, and the machine answers the question for you with essentially a technology tone of voice, not a brand tone of voice. So I would say nowadays, I think you have to standardize a lot more, and then you have to culturally adjust to domestic markets. Yeah. And an example of that, when Telefonica took over, every other business was rebranded. And we said, for us to move away from the O2 brand would be madness. But what we did do was we changed the company name to Telefonica UK. And on everybody's payslip, it said you were paid by Telefonica. Okay. But what we said internally was, we're proud of Telefonica, but we're passionate about O2. Yeah. And we addressed it head on and said, we're not trying to blend the two things. It's an and, not an R.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's the thing, because oftentimes you try to blend and get the best of it, and
nobody feels ownership of it. It's not for anyone very often.
The other thing I suppose too, when you think about it, is as you think back in the career, you know, with success comes the risk of distraction, right? As CEO, you're kind of going, oh, you get more money, you get a bit of success, and you suddenly go, well, do you know what we should do? We should branch into this. We should branch into that. Now, how do you balance the need to grow with not getting distracted down rabbit holes?
So, great question. We actually definitely had this as a live debate stroke threat in O2. Because we had a run of 3 or 4 years where, honestly, our poo didn't smell and everything we did in the market worked. And so people were saying, well, you could extend the brand into leisure. You could extend the brand into holidays. You could extend the brand into, you know, clothing. You could do all these things. And what we did as a team, and I particularly said, whether we can do it is not the question, is it worthy of O2?
Yeah.
And the message of is it worthy of O2 was really around, if you're not going to change the rules of the game, you know, we had this idea of divorce the industry, rewrite the rules of the game. We fundamentally believed we were an experience business, not a technology business. And that truthfully was why we succeeded, because we approached the market differently. We were solving for a different insight. So that was how we avoided getting distracted, was the fact that we can do it is not a reason to do it. Unless we're going to change the rules of the game by us doing it, then it's not worthy of us spending our time on it. And that kept us tight. We did try to do things in financial services, insurance and health, where we were probably ahead of our time and where you see, you know, telcos now more involved in those sectors because they're very technology driven. But we had an O2 wallet before anyone had a wallet on their mobile phone.
Yeah.
And everyone loved the idea, but adoption was poor. We worked with the NHS. We did loads of trials. But when it came to turning a trial into a paid use, they were very reluctant to allocate budget to unproven technology.
The other thing I think that's important in this kind of regard, particularly around the telecoms and around the telecoms that were that industry at the time you were in it, is the whole role of the regulator.
Yeah.
Right. Massive. And like you could argue now when you look back, right, and it's not disparaging, they made some really bad decisions. Like and probably to the detriment of the long-term viability of a lot of businesses in the industry, but also the industry overall.
Yeah, and again, most people won't remember, but when the industry was first formed, the regulator's view was that the networks were essentially forbidden from selling airtime directly to the customers. So you had all these service providers interposed in the middle. So you had essentially network engineers running a business over here, selling wholesale to people who didn't actually have control of the service and the experience, and then passing it on in a bucket to you in 300
minutes.
Trying
to sell experience to people that they had no control over that experience.
Precisely. And so the fragmentation caused by the regulator highlighted failure in multiple places. And what we slowly got back to was, if I'm going to hold the industry to account, they need to be responsible end to end. Then the second thing was, we need infrastructure competition. Well, the answer is, I've always believed in this, and where largely telecoms has got to is what you would call a co-opetition model. So you cooperate to compete. Being inefficient at getting to the market isn't in the customer's benefit. So what you need to do is be as efficient as possible in delivering your product or services to market, and then compete the hell out of each other at the customer interface, giving real choice. And so the idea of building 4 or even 5 networks is just utter madness.
Yeah.
If you had said to people, I tell you what, build 6 bores to the tunnel, you know, going from England to France, people say, don't be so bloody stupid. But they'd happily tell you, build 6 masts on the top of the hill, paint 1 green, 1 blue, 1 red, 1 white, you know.
And you kind of go, why? Because we want competition.
Well, that's not the way. And it's fundamentally that misunderstanding of competition. I mean, I bought out one of the distributors at one time, and the Competition Commission actually considered that every individual store I bought was a market in its own right. And they wanted to know who else was on the street. I mean, are you serious? You know, ridiculous. It's better now. The approach of the regulator in the US was always slightly different. Yes, they broke up AT&T, but that was a monopoly. But largely, they were always willing to have a smaller number of scale players
who
led actually make through investment.
Switching tacks in terms of another part of another duty, I suppose, of the CEO. When it comes to people, are you a hire talent or develop from within?
I'm a talent-driven leader, and I'm not trying to be clever by not answering your question. I honestly believe that the job of a CEO is like a coach in a sports team. It's you gather talent, but the talent is not just individual players, but it's the ability of those players to play to a particular style, which in a business case is a strategy. Yeah. And in that regard, I think a blend of people who are homegrown and developed from inside, but they can then be amplified by bringing in specialists, you know, bringing in a striker, a holding midfielder or whatever else, that improves the overall performance of the team. So I honestly think it's an and rather than an R. Okay. When I got to Verizon, truth is, I changed every single person in the leadership team over a period of 2 years, and about 60% of those I promoted from within and 40% I recruited outside.
And then in that regard, then when you have people that are in that team and they are the best at what they do, but the collateral damage is there. So the idea of, you know, you've got a talented asshole, right?
Yeah.
So what do you do with a talented asshole?
It's very clear. The what can always be delivered. The how is the differentiator. Yeah. So if somebody doesn't fit the team dynamic, well, then they have to go.
Okay.
Plain and simple. I would make no bones about it. It was a great line. When I first took over as a CEO, I was sent out with a group of people. A consultancy runs a thing called Top Dog, and it was bringing you to Top Dog organizations to give you a flavor of what good looks like as you're about to do your first C-suite role. So I went out with people from British Gas, various others, fabulous group. And lady in recruitment in Google quoted this line, which I've quoted forever afterwards, is better a hole than an asshole. Mm. And it's absolutely right. A senior person resigns and you think, oh, shoot, I've got to run out, get somebody in or whatever else is. Take your time, get it right. You know, marry in haste, repent of the letter, as they say. So definitely, I've always, that resonates with me, better a hole than an asshole.
That's a good one. I'll remember that one. Right.
So, as long as you attribute the quote to me.
Yeah, I will. No, every time. When you think about the role of the CEO, I'm a real firm believer in the fact that you don't necessarily get better at the job, but you get quicker at making the important decisions.
I'm not sure I agree.
Okay.
Actually, and I tell you why, and maybe it's just my journey. I genuinely didn't expect to be a CEO.
Hmm.
And luckily enough, my boss and chairman at O2 saw in me, before we became part of Telefonica, the potential for me to be a CEO. And when I first took over, I kind of thought my cupboard of experience for being a CEO was bare.
Mm.
What I think the learning is and the journey that why you do get better is, what you learn to do is apply the actual experience you have to a different context.
Yeah.
So instead of being the subject matter expert or the I'll offer my opinion, somebody else decides, you bring. And I think the biggest learning of all is understanding the difference between consensus and conclusion. When you're the CEO, 90% of the big decisions rest with you. But people being heard before you make that decision is absolutely critical to them feeling they're part of the team. But what tends to happen is people aren't clear, and you end up with people contributing, thinking that we're going to come to consensus, and then, frankly, falling out
because
when their view isn't reflected in the decision. So probably the thing I learned over time that made me a better CEO was to apply real life experience I had, but in a different way because I was the CEO. And secondly, to be really clear in marking explicitly, I'm looking for your opinion before I decide, versus this is so important that if we don't all agree, we shouldn't do it.
Yeah. And then in that regard, then, what do you think, what personal characteristics do you think are most important as a CEO?
I'll probably say three things. I genuinely believe it's a strength not to be the smartest person in the room.
Okay.
And that's not just false modesty. I genuinely do. I think there's a reason why you have two ears and one mouth. Mm-hmm. The ratio of listening to talking should be 2-1.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the third thing is authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
Because actually, people will follow you if they believe that you believe. But so many people lose their authenticity. Mm-hmm. They talk, you know, corporate bullshit, and they give the whatever else, and they rally, and they love the sound of their own voice, and the whatever. honestly, the most powerful I've been as a CEO is when I've sat down with my team and I've said, I had to go to the group board and explain why we haven't delivered what we needed to do. And guess what? I felt pretty pissed about that. Yeah. And let's be honest about it. It's my fault.
Yeah.
But we're all in this together. Yeah. Yeah. So what did we do that created that situation where we weren't able to represent ourselves in the best light? Mm-hmm. And I can tell you, not a single person walked out of that room without feeling, I need to do better.
Mm. Switching tack slightly then, because you've done both roles, talk to me about the fundamental difference you see as being a CEO and being a chairman.
Yeah, great question. And not everybody who's been a good CEO does the transition well, if I'm honest, my perspective. I think chairs are essentially a combination of mentor and advisor, in my view. And yes, there's governance and other things, but good chairing, and when I've been the beneficiary of it, and what I try to do is be the space in which the outside is brought in, context is defined broader than I can only see what's right in front of me because I'm working on this particular big issue. And then that ability to be able to coach, mentor people into, well, actually, maybe there are a wider set of choices than you perhaps can see immediately. Or maybe the decision can be broken down into bite-sized chunks. Because sometimes people think there's this big, huge decision and fundamentally the organization goes left or right. 9 times out of 10, there are components in that where you have real clarity and sub-decisions to be made. And I think the other thing I would say about being a chair is you have to aspire for your CEO to grow into your job. Mm. Because otherwise there isn't enough space between the two of you. If two people park in the car park in the morning thinking they're running the business, you already have a problem.
Well, then where are you? Because I'm always interested in this and I've asked a few. I asked Gary McGann the same question. Where are you? Because we see it much more in the US where the chairman and CEO is the same person.
Well, I would never, and I was very clear on this, I would never work for an executive chairman.
Right.
And in the US, it's the predominant model. And what that means is if you've got a group structure where people have discrete business units, it can work. If you've got one business unit, you potentially have two people who are turning up in the morning thinking they're running things. Very interestingly, Verizon has just changed out its chairman and CEO. And for the first time ever, they've split the role to have an independent chairman, Mark Bertolini, and a new CEO who the first time Dan Schuller, who is Schulman, I should say, who was on the board as a non-exec, is just CEO. Yeah. He's not chair and CEO. And I personally think that's a much better model of governance.
Yeah. So how do you manage your board or your investors when things aren't going well?
So, look, I think there's two things, and it's the same whether you're an exec or as a chair in the board. You have to live by a mantra of no surprises. Mm. So communicate earlier is always the thing. Trying to solve it before it's an issue rarely ends up being in your best interests. Preparing people for there could be a scenario, there could be an outcome here. You know, we have some challenges against the, you know, the quarter forecast, whatever it is. Then coming back to them with, and this is what we're doing about it, gives them evidence that you're owning it and taking control of it. So I would always say prep the board early for the bad news and surprise them on the upside rather than scare them on the downside. I think it changes when you have fundamental issues like, for example, at Marks & Spencer's, we had a cyber attack.
Yeah.
Well, all the rules go out the window in a situation like that. You know, your budget, your forecast, your guidance to the market, your everything else. Is, you know, you're just hopeful that you'll be able to open the stores the following day. There, I think a different dynamic happens, and that is that you defer apportioning blame and you work on addressing the specific of the issue at the time. And there'll always be a time to go back and say, did we leave the back door open? Was there something we could have done differently? But it's not the time when you're restoring the business. And that sense of we're all in it together without losing a sight of accountability, I think is very powerful.
Is there much of a difference, without having to go into specifics of it, but is there much of a difference between the Six Nations board and the M&S board in terms of a commercial versus...
Very different. And it's different because of the governance model. So I'm an independent chair at Six Nations, and I'm a member of the board as a non-exec, but not the chair at Marks & Spencer's. I vote on everything at Marks & Spencer's when it comes to the board for voting. I'm a non-voting independent chairman at Six Nations. And the reason for that is there are certain rugby matters particularly which have commercial implications where essentially only the six unions are allowed to vote on those things. So in that model, which I actually think is a good thing, my mandate is defined by my power to persuade.
Right.
If I can't carry the room, then I don't have an overarching says, well, if you don't like it, I'm still going to vote it through.
Yeah. But it's also, in that case, it's not that you don't have a view on them, you just don't have a vote on them.
Precisely. Yeah. And so what you still have to lead, like any chairman should, and with my CEO, but I need to be able to persuade people and convince them that this is the right thing to do. And what's interesting, obviously the six CEOs of the unions are commercial, who are my shareholders, but their breadth of commerciality in the sense of having worked in multinationals or international business or other things isn't always the same as, you know, a broader business person. So that idea of bringing the outside in is really important. So there's a context that isn't just the narrow definition of next Saturday's game against the All Blacks or whatever the case may be.
When you think
as a man who's going to Chicago in 10 days.
I'm a man going to Chicago the week after, unfortunately, but that's
bad
a different
timing.
Matter in when you think back through everything that, and everything that you've learned along the way, what are the one or two really important things you've learned from other executives or companies along the way?
Yeah, great question. Probably the one, and my group CFO at O2 BT, as we demerged out, was really helpful on this, is really work out what the question is before you try to answer it. And that may sound obvious, but the point is, inside a business issue, when you peel the onion, there's probably a series of different things. And breaking it down and being really clear what the issue is, it's symptoms versus cause. You know, you can treat all the symptoms you like, you can put a cream on it, but if unless you understand what the underlying cause is, you're still going to have the hives come back or the itch or whatever it is. So that one was a big one for me. And the second thing I would say that's really important, to be a successful leader, build a successful team. Because this idea, when early in my career, you know, when I was newly qualified, I worked genuinely 20 hours a day and I got ahead.
Yeah.
But guess what? That's not a scalable management style. So this idea is, it's not what you do, it's what you make happen.
Yeah.
And to do that, to be a successful leader, build a successful team. And that's the real insight that I learned from others around me. Jerry Murphy, when I worked with him at NFC and others, it was all about understanding the team dynamic. And probably why I've ended up being the chair of a sports organization, because the team dynamic is something that I absolutely recognize. And I was a half decent player at a few bits and pieces at times.
Then here we go. Do you hate losing or love winning?
I don't compete with anyone except myself. And this is answering the question, honestly. I'm unbelievably hard on myself. But that means that if I can look myself in the eye and say, I did my very best, that's good enough for me, because I'm very demanding of myself. I'm much easier on the people around me, to be honest with you. It's not that I'm weak in that sense. So from that point of view is, my wins and losses don't always tally with the team win and the team loss. Yeah. That's the truth of it.
Yeah, it's a bit like that idea. And you see a lot of sports people, it's about the outcome is the outcome.
Yeah.
But if you've stuck to your process and you can stand by the process and you did the process, the result will be the result almost.
Because truthfully, my overarching kind of philosophy is, if it wasn't different because you were there, it doesn't count.
Yeah.
So if you were on the field and you won by 5 goals and you made no contribution, guess what? No credit attributes to you.
Yeah. Fast or slow decision making?
I would go actually for fast decision making, but clarity about the fact pack. So if you're all working on the same set of facts, even if it's not perfect, go quick.
Yeah.
That's what I would say.
And then are you data-based or gut-based when it comes to decisions?
I think nowadays, anyone who says they're gut-based, respectfully, is being naive. The access to data at speed is so much better today than it was 20 years ago. I love instinct on top, but why would you debate the facts when you can actually prove
get the facts? Yeah, I'd agree with you there. Has fear of failure ever been a driving force for you?
No. I'm kind of wired a bit differently. Mm-hmm. I love a challenge. I never expected to do half of the things I've ended up doing. So I, you know, even things like going to the States. I mean, now you can say, because I was successful, real privilege. A load of people said to me, why would you put your career and your brand and reputation at risk going off into a market you don't know and doing something? I said, because it's an adventure and somebody's going to give me the opportunity.
But you also got to back yourself. Like if you know.
Yeah. And you do. And, you know, some people I think are naive in the way they back themselves. Mm-hmm. They overstate their things. Yeah. And it goes back to this idea of, if you're smart enough to know you're not the smartest person in the room, you'll probably create the conditions for success. If you don't realise, then hubris will probably get you.
Yeah. I like asking this question. I'd be interested to see what the answer is. You're going to have a dinner party for six people. There's you, me and four others. Who are your four choices?
I'll start with an odd one. Mother Teresa of Calcutta. Okay. My mum was involved in a charity that occasionally when Mother Teresa came to Ireland, she would get to meet her. And bizarrely, the question I'd asked to Mother Teresa was, as probably the most powerful woman in the world for a period of time, why is there almost zero legacy? Mm-hmm. First question. Second one is, I'd invite David Beckham, and it's only because my wife thinks he's the most attractive man on the planet. And I'll tell you a 30-second anecdote. I went to see David Beckham at Inter Miami when I had just bought a business called TrackPhone, which was kind of a prepay business with a high Latino customer base. And I thought, Miami team, perfect. We'll go on the shirts. We'll sponsor. And it's the only time Elaine said that she would come on the business trip.
Amazingly enough.
So we flew down on a Saturday morning. And there is a photo, which I'll show you after the podcast, which is me, Elaine and David on the field.
And Elaine is pushing you out of the photo.
So that's two. Others, I'd love to have, if I'm allowed, somebody, again deceased, my grandfather.
Okay.
My dad's been a huge influence on me, as my mom has, but my dad is one of the most gentle people I've ever come across. He is like the Pied Piper with children, and yet he's unbelievably effective. So that balance, and it was born out of his environment. And his dad was lost at sea. He was a merchant seaman who used to work for the Irish Lights and serve the offshore lighthouses. And their ship, the Isolde, was bombed off the Wexford coast in December 1940, and he was lost at sea. And having had the privilege of still having my dad at 96 and seeing my children grow up with their grandfather, I would love to have had time with my grandfather and know him, because I love the man that is his son, and I would have loved to have known him. And probably for the fourth one, I'd probably, just to cause devilment, I'd have somebody like Piers Morgan or somebody in.
Roy Keane is always a name that appears in it for exactly that category.
But Piers, and you know, this part of me kind of likes Piers, and there's part of me that sometimes think, my God, what a prat. Yeah. But he has strong Irish connection, you know, so I think he'd be fun at a dinner party.
You've been what I would call a professional management all your career, right? Did you ever think about the entrepreneurial space?
It's a great question. Actually, I do a ton in that space now. So although the portfolio says it's the Six Nations and it's M&S, about 40% of my time, a lot of it pro bono, is mentoring founders.
Okay.
And I specifically focus almost exclusively on female founders.
Okay.
So if you look at a market like Ireland, the Ufurnish business, Deirdre McGettrick and her husband Ray founded that. Pat McCann's the chair there. I'm about to take over chairing that business, and I'm invested in it. Somebody like Arena Maycock with Chirp Family, where again, I've been an advisor with Arena for years. The one that you mentioned in the intro, Core Labs, which is founded by a lady called Sabrina Del Prete. So I'm now getting exposure to the early stage and the smaller entrepreneurial as a mentor, advisor, and an investor.
Okay.
And one of the great organizations that I'm sure you've come across is a thing called Awaken Hub, run by a lady called Mary McKenna and a team there, Claire and Denise and Sinead and the team. But that's an entrepreneurial network, north and south, for women.
Right.
And I have the privilege of being one of the two male advisors to the organization. But again, really learning how I can turn big corporate experience into relevant to founders and startups, but also recognizing that 2% of the money that's raised by founders goes to female founders, another 10% to male and female joint founders. If nothing else, the investment hypothesis means you can buy cheaper into a female founder than you can into a male. Yeah. So I might as well use the accountancy qualification.
Pressure is a privilege. So how do you handle pressure?
I sleep like a baby.
Do you?
Honestly. You know what? And it's again, it's not that, it probably did sound flippant and I didn't mean it to. You should only worry about things that you could have done something about and you haven't.
Mm.
Stuff that's outside your control, why would you spend time worrying about it?
Yeah.
So I'm very philosophical like that. So I will be absolutely forensic about getting after stuff that I can control, that I can manage, that I can address. And honestly, the rest is the rest.
So do you obsess about small things?
No, I don't. As you would see from my desk sometimes is, I kind of like clutter.
Yeah.
I had a line when I was running Verizon, because in business, there's a real danger that people delegate up all the time. You know, it's easier for the boss to make the big decision than me is. But honestly, I look and I had an approach to allocating my time, which says, focus on things that only you can do.
Mm.
And I used to go through, looking back 90 days in my calendar and looking forward 6 months, and me and my business manager would sit down and say, have you allocated your time to the priorities you told the board or the shareholders? And are you focusing on the element that only you can do? Or are you putting your arm around everybody and helping where, frankly, they should be doing the job themselves? So in that regard, I try to be big picture, outside in, and focus on the few things that probably only the boss can ultimately decide.
Yeah. There may be a simple answer to this one, but how did you decide when it was the right time to leave a role in your career?
Good question. As a general point, I think the governance rules, which says 9 years for a non-exec, whatever else is, I think they're a good proxy for execs too. If you've been in role for 6 or 7 years, you know, there's probably a challenge in maintaining the level of differentiated impact that there was in the first years. So my view would be any CEO's in role more than 6 or 7 years, probably time to change. My career genuinely is, although somebody who's been quite focused all his career, the moves have been happenstance. Yeah. So, for example, the year I did the Leaving Cert, 1981, the examiners went on strike, so the papers weren't actually marked. So it got to October, and there were no offers from college. So my plan was to do law in UCD. And 3 weeks later, I got my offer. But by that time, I'd signed a training contract to go and work for Touche Ross. Because guess what? I wasn't going to hang around and wait. So I'm an accidental accountant. Then I went into telecoms because guess what? I went and followed my boss.
Do you think you would have been a better accountant or a better lawyer is the question?
Well, I like the sound of my own voice. So that probably would have helped in the law. I probably would have ended up, as a barrister if I had gone that way. Honestly, and it's not false saying it, I've been incredibly lucky in the circumstances that have surrounded me. But I think I'll quote Gary Player, the harder you practice, the luckier you get. Yeah,
definitely. Definitely the case. Right. We've come to the black book time. Here we go. Keep your fingers crossed, lads. Right. Right. Now, this is an interesting one, right? And it's interesting because of a lot of the charity work you do around education and opportunity, right? What phrase or advice would you like to be passed down to your grandkids and their kids? Advice that will survive the test of time.
Oh, that's brilliant. Ultimately, it's not what you do, it's what you make happen. Mm. I think there's a responsibility in our society that's sometimes overlooked, that everybody needs to show up. And it doesn't matter about hierarchy, it doesn't matter anything else is, but everybody has to put in if they reasonably expect to take out. And yeah. I don't mean that in a socialist or a whatever else way, but if you're not going to make a difference, you know, you shouldn't. And so I believe the overarching thing in our society at the moment is we have no shortage of talent, but we've got increasingly poor at matching that talent to opportunity. And what I focus on in the education stuff, in youth stuff and other things is trying to identify areas where we can improve the prospect of inclusive talent being mapped to the opportunities that our society has.
And the problems that the society
exactly.
has.
It's the challenges and the opportunities. Yeah. I think we have the answer to everything. I just think we're increasingly poor at matching. We still have an analog education system in a largely digital employment and economic environment. So I'm hugely positive. I also think things like AI will be positive. So if there's one thing to pass on, it's make it different because you were there.
Yeah. All right, well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I'd just like to thank my guest, Ronan Dunne. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe, or comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks, and we'll see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning, the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.